He said nothing. He strode through the white marble entryway, entering the sitting room, which was decorated in deep reds to contrast with the white floor. He did not sit, but remained standing with his arms behind his back, studying the map of Arad Doman he'd ordered placed on the wall. The aged map hung where a fine oil painting once had, and seemed completely out of place in the room. On the map, there was a black ink mark at the edge of a small lake to the southeast. Rand had placed it there the morning after Curb died. It marked Natron's Barrow. "It was a fort, once," Rand said absently.
"The city where Grendahl is hiding?" Min said, walking up beside him.
He shook his head.
"It's not a city. I've sent scouts. It's just a solitary structure built long ago to watch the mountains of mist and guard against incursion through the passes by Manetheran. It hasn't been used for military purposes since the Trolloc Wars. There's hardly need to worry about invasion from Two Rivers people who don't even remember the name Manetheran."
Min nodded. "Though Arad Doman did get invaded by a shepherd from the Two Rivers. Once that would have made him smile. She kept forgetting that he didn't do that anymore."
"A few centuries back," Rand said, eyes narrowed in thought, "the king of Arad Doman seized Natron's Barrow back in the name of the throne. For some time before, it had been occupied by a minor noble family from Toman Head, who had been trying to set up their own new kingdom. That happens on Almuth Plain occasionally. The Damani king liked the location and used the fortress as a palace instead. He spent a great deal of time there, so much, in fact, that several of his merchant enemies gained too much power in Bandar Eben. The king fell, but his successors also used the fortress, and it became a popular retreat for the crown when the king needed relaxation. The practice dwindled during the last 100 years or so, until it was granted to a distant cousin of the king about 50 years back. Their family has used it ever since. Among the general Damani populace, Natron's Barrow has been largely forgotten."
"Except by Al-Salam?" Min asked.
Rand shook his head.
"No. I doubt he knew of it at all. I learned this history from the royal archivist, who had to search for hours to locate the name of the family using the place. There has been no contact with them for months, though they used to visit towns on occasion. The few farmsteaders in the area say that someone new seems to be living in the palace, though nobody knows where the former owner went. They seem surprised that they've never thought about how odd that is."
He eyed her.
"This is exactly the sort of location Grendahl would choose as her center of power. It's Jewel, a forgotten fortress of beauty and power, ancient and regal. Close enough to Bandar Eben for her to have a hand in ruling Arad Doman, but far enough away to be defensible and secluded. I made a mistake in my searches for her. I assumed she'd want a beautiful manor with gardens and grounds. I should have realized, it isn't just beauty that she collects, but prestige. A magnificent fortress for kings fits her just as much as an elegant manor house, particularly since this one is more palace than fort now."
Footsteps in the entryway behind drew Min's attention, and a few seconds later a servant ushered in Nynaeve and the foppish Ramshalan, with his pointed beard and thin mustache. Today he had tiny bells at the end of the beard, and wore a black velvet beauty mark on his cheek, also in the shape of a bell. He wore a loose silk costume of green and blue, the sleeves drooping, ruffled shirt poking out beneath. Min didn't care what fashion dictated. The man looked ridiculous, like a disheveled peacock.
"My lord called for me," Ramshalan said, bowing extravagantly toward Rand.
Rand didn't turn away from the map.
"I have a puzzle for you, Ramshalan," he said. "I want to know what you think."
"Please don't hesitate, my lord."
"Then tell me this. How do I outthink an enemy I know is smarter than I am?"
"My lord," Ramshalan bowed a second time, as if worried that Rand hadn't noticed the first one. Surely you seek to trick me. There is nobody more intelligent than yourself.
I wish that were true, Rand said softly. I face some of the most crafty people who have ever lived. My current foe understands the minds of others in a way that I cannot hope to match. So how do I defeat her? She will vanish the moment I threaten her, running to one of a dozen other refuges she is sure to have set up. She won't fight me head on, yet if I destroy her fortress in a surprise attack, I risk letting her slip away and never knowing if I've finished her.
A problem indeed, my lord, Ramchalan said.
He looked confused. Rand nodded, as if to himself. I have to peer into her eyes, see into her soul, and know that it's her that I face and not some decoy. I have to do that without frightening her into running.
How?
How can I kill a foe who is more clever than myself? A foe who is impossible to surprise, yet who is also unwilling to confront me?
Ramchalan looked overwhelmed by those demands.
Ah, my lord, if your foe is that clever, then perhaps your best course of action is to request the aid of someone more clever.
Rand turned to him.
An excellent suggestion, Ramchalan. Perhaps I've already done just that.
The man swelled. He thinks that's why Rand summoned him, Min realized. She had to hide her smile with a turn of the head and a raised hand.
If you had an enemy such as this, Ramchalan, what would you do? Rand asked. I grow impatient. Give me an answer.
I'd make an alliance, my lord, Ramchalan said, without pausing for another second.
Anyone that powerful would make a better friend than foe, I say.
Idiot, Min thought. If your enemy is that crafty and ruthless, an alliance will only end with an assassin's dagger in your back.
Another excellent suggestion, Rand said softly. But I am still intrigued by the first comment you made. You said I need allies who are smarter than I am, and that is true. It is time for you to be off, then.
My lord, Ramchalan said.
You are to be my emissary, Rand said, waving a hand.
A gateway suddenly split the air on the far side of the room, shearing through the fine rug at the floor.
Too many of the Demani bloodborn are hiding, scattered through the country. I would have them as my allies, but it would be a drain on my time to seek each one in person. Fortunately, I have you to go on my behalf.
Ramchalan looked excited about the prospect. Through the gateway, Min could see towering pines, and the air on the other side was cold and crisp. Min turned and glanced at Nynaeve, dressed in blue and white again. The Aes Sedai watched the exchange with calculating eyes, and Min could read her own emotions in Nynaeve's expression. What was Rand's game?
Beyond that gateway, Rand said, you will find a hill leading down to an ancient palace which is inhabited by a minor Demani merchant family. It is the first of many places I shall send you. Go in my name, and seek those who rule the keep. See if they are willing to support me, or if they even know about me. Offer them rewards for allegiance. Since you have proven yourself clever, I will let you determine the terms. I haven't the mind for those sorts of negotiations myself.
Yes, my lord, the man said, swelling further, though he did eye the gateway with concern,
distrustful like most people, of the one power, particularly when wielded by a man. If it were opportune, this man would switch loyalties as quickly as he had when Lady Chatmar had fallen. What was Rand thinking, sending a popinjay like this to meet with Grendahl?
Go, Rand said.
Ramchalan took a few hesitant steps toward the gateway.
My lord dragon, could I perhaps have something in the way of an escort? No need to frighten or alarm the people there, Rand said without turning from the map. Cold air continued to blow through the gateway. Go quickly and return, Ramchalan. I will leave the gateway open until you are back. My patience is not limitless, and there are many I could turn to for this mission.
The man seemed to calculate the risks.
Of course, Lord Dragon. He took a deep breath and walked through the portal, his steps uncomfortable, like those of a house cat venturing out into a puddle of water. Min found herself feeling sorry for the man. Fallen needles crackled as Ramchalan moved off into the forest. A breeze hissed through the trees. It was an odd sound to hear while standing in the comforts of the mansion. Rand left the gateway open, still staring at his map.
"All right, Rand," Nynaeve demanded after a few minutes, her arms folded. "What game is this?"
"How would you beat her, Nynaeve?" Rand asked.
"She won't be goaded into fighting me, like Ravin or Samael were. She won't be easily trapped, either. Grendel understands people better than anyone. Twisted she may be, but she is crafty, and should not be underestimated. Tors Margin made that mistake, I recall, and you know his fate."
Min frowned.
"Who?"
she asked, looking at Nynaeve. The Aes Sedai shrugged. Rand glanced at them.
"I believe in history he was known as Tors the Broken."
Again Min shook her head. Nynaeve joined her. Neither was deeply versed in history, true, but Rand acted as if they should know this name. Rand's face hardened, and he blushed just faintly, turning away from them.
"The question remains," he said, voice soft but tense. "How would you fight her, Nynaeve?"
"I don't care to play your games, Randalthor," Nynaeve replied with a huff. "You've already decided what you intend to do. Why ask me?"
"Because what I am about to do should frighten me," he said. "It doesn't."
Min shivered. Rand nodded to the maidens standing in the doorway. Moving lightly, they crossed the room, leaped through the gateway, and spread through the pine forest, quickly vanishing from sight. All 20 together made less noise than Ramchalan had. Min waited. On the other side of the gateway, a distant sun was hidden from sight, giving a late afternoon light to the shadowed forest floor. After a few moments, white-haired Sulin stepped into view and nodded to Rand. "All clear."
"Come," Rand said, and walked to the gateway. Min followed, though Nynaeve, breaking into a trot, beat her to the gateway.
They stepped out onto a carpet of brown pine needles, dirtied from a long slumber beneath the vanished winter snows. Branches nudged one another in the breeze, and the mountain air was more chilly than the breeze had indicated. Min wished for a cloak, but there wasn't time to go fetch one. Rand strode directly through the forest, Nynaeve trotting up to him and speaking in a low voice. Nynaeve wouldn't get anything useful out of Rand, not when he was in this kind of mood. They would just have to see what he revealed. Min caught sight of some of the Aiel in the woods, but only brief glimpses when they obviously weren't taking care to hide. They certainly had taken well to life in the wetlands. How did the people raised in the waste know so instinctively how to hide in a forest? Up ahead, the trees broke. Min hastened to join Rand and Nynaeve, who had stopped at the top of a gently sloping ridge. Here they could see over the forest, and the trees continued down below like a sea of green and brown. The pines parted at the shores of a small mountain lake, caught in a triangular depression of the land. Atop a ridge of its own, high above the water, was an impressive white stone structure. Rectangular and tall, it was built in the form of several towers, stacked atop one another, each one slightly thinner than the one beneath. That gave the palace an elegant shape. Fortified, yet palatial.
"It's beautiful," she said breathlessly.
"It was built during a different time," Rand said, "a time when people still thought that the majesty of a structure lent its strength."
The palace was distant, but not so distant that Min couldn't make out the figures of men walking the battlements on guard, halberds at their shoulders, breastplates reflecting the late sunlight. A late party of hunters rode in through the gates, a fine buck deer lashed to the pack horse, and a group of workers chopped at a fallen tree nearby, perhaps for firewood. A pair of serving women in white carried poles,
bucket at each end, up from the lake, and lights were winking on in windows the length of the structure. It was a living, working estate, bundled up in a single, massive building.
"Do you think Ramchalan found his way?" Nynaeve said, arms folded, obviously trying not to look impressed.
"Even a fool like him could not miss that," Rand said, eyes narrowing.
He still carried the statuette in his pocket. Min wished he had left the thing behind. It made her uncomfortable the way he fingered it, caressed it.
"So you sent Ramchalan to die," Nynaeve said.
"What will that accomplish?"
"She won't kill him," Rand said.
"How can you be so sure of that?"
"It isn't her way," Rand said. "Not when she can use him against me."
"You don't expect her to believe that story you told him?" Min said. "About sending him out to test the allegiance of the Damani lords?"
Rand slowly shook his head.
"No. I hope for her to believe something of that tale, but I do not expect it. I meant what I said about her, Min. She's more crafty than I am, and I fear that she knows me far better than I know her. She will compel Ramchalan and pull from him that entire conversation we had. From there she will find a way to use that conversation against me."
"How?" Min asked.
"I don't know. I wish I did. She'll think of something clever, then infect Ramchalan with a very subtle compulsion that I won't be able to anticipate. I'll be left with the choice to keep him nearby and see what he does, or to send him away. But of course she will think of that as well, and whatever I do will set in motion her other plans."
"You make it sound as if you can't win," Nynaeve said, frowning. She didn't seem to notice the chill at all. In fact, neither did Rand. Whatever that trick about ignoring cold and heat was, Min had never been able to figure it out. They claimed it had nothing to do with the power, but if that were so, why were Rand and the Aes Sedai the only ones who could manage it? The Aiel didn't seem to be bothered by the cold either, but they didn't count. They never seemed bothered by regular human concerns, though they could be very touchy about the most random and insignificant things.
"We can't win, you say?" Rand asked. "Is that what we're trying to do? Win?"
Nynaeve raised an eyebrow.
"Do you not answer questions anymore?"
Rand turned, looking at Nynaeve. Standing on the other side of him, Min couldn't see what was in his face, but she could see Nynaeve grow pale. It was her own fault. Couldn't she sense how on edge Rand was? Perhaps Min's chill didn't just come from the cold. She moved up close to him, but he didn't put his arm around her as he might once have. When he finally turned away from Nynaeve, the Aes Sedai slumped slightly, as if she had been dangling, held up by his gaze. Rand did not speak for some time, and so they waited quietly on the mountain ridge as the distant sun made its way toward the horizon. Shadows lengthened, fingers stretching away from the sun. Down below, by the fortress walls, a group of grooms began walking some horses to give them exercise. More lights had been lit in the fortress windows. How many people did Grendel have in there? Scores, if not hundreds. A crashing sound in the brush suddenly drew Min's attention. It was accompanied by curses. She jumped as the noise cut off quite abruptly. A small group of Aiel approached a few moments later, leading a disheveled Ramchalan, his fine clothing stuck with needles and scratched from branches. He dusted himself off, then took a step toward Rand. The maidens held him back. He glanced at them, cocking his head.
"My Lord Dragon? Is he infected?" Rand asked of Nynaeve.
"By what?" she asked.
"Grendel's touch."
Nynaeve walked over to Ramchalan and looked at him for a moment. She hissed and said,
"Yes."
"Rand, he's under a heavy compulsion. There are a lot of weaves here. Not as bad as the Chandler's apprentice, or maybe just more subtle."
"I say," Ramchalan said. "My Lord Dragon, what is going on? The lady of the castle down there was quite friendly. She's an ally, my lord. You have nothing to fear from her. Very refined, I must say.
Is that so? Rand asked quietly.
It was growing dark, sun setting behind the distant mountains. Besides the dim evening light, the only illumination came from the still-open gateway behind them. It shone with lamplight, an inviting portal back to warmth, away from this place of shadow and coldness. Rand's voice sounded so hard, worse than Min had ever heard it before.
Rand, she said, touching his arm. Let's go back.
I have something I must do, he said, not looking at her.
Think about it some more, Min said. At least take some advice. We can ask Cadswain or—
Cadswain held me in a box, Min, he said very softly.
His face was clasped in shadow, but as he turned toward her, his eyes reflected the light from the open gateway, orange and red. There was an edge of anger to his tone.
I shouldn't have mentioned Cadswain, she realized. The woman's name was one of the few things that could still get emotion out of him.
A box, Min, Rand whispered. Though Cadswain's box had walls that were invisible, it was as binding as any that ever held me. Her tongue was far more painful a rod than any that was taken to my skin. I see that now.
Rand pulled away from Min's touch.
What is the purpose of all this? Nynaeve demanded. You sent this man to suffer a compulsion, knowing what it would do to him? I won't watch another man squirm and die because of this. Whatever she has compelled him to do, I won't remove it. It will be your own fault if it brings your death.
My lord? Ramshalan asked. The growing terror in his voice put Min on edge.
The sun set. Rand was now just a silhouette. The fortress was only a black profile with lanterns lighting the holes in its walls. Rand stepped up to the lip of the ridge, removing the access key from his pocket. It started to glow just faintly, a red light coming from its very heart. Nynaeve inhaled sharply.
Neither of you were there when Kalandor failed me, he said into the night. It happened twice. Once I tried to use it to raise the dead, but I got only a puppeted body. Once I tried to use it to destroy the Seanchan, but I caused as much death among my own armies as I caused among theirs. Cadswain told me that the second failure came from a flaw in Kalandor itself. It cannot be controlled by a lone man, you see. It only works if he's in a box. Kalandor is a carefully enticing leash, intended to make me surrender willingly.
The access key's globe burst alight with a more brilliant color, seeming crystalline. The light within was scarlet, the core brilliant and bright, as if someone had dropped a glowing rock into a pool of blood.
I see a different answer to my problems, Rand said, voice still almost a whisper. Both times Kalandor failed me, I was being reckless with my emotion. I allowed temper to drive me. I can't kill in anger, Min. I have to keep that anger inside. I must channel it as I channel the one power. Each death must be deliberate, intentional.
Min couldn't speak, couldn't phrase her fears, couldn't find the words to make him stop. His eyes remained in the darkness somehow, despite the liquid light he held before him. That light hurled shadows away from his figure, as if he was the point of a silent explosion. Min turned to Nynaeve. The Aes Sedai watched with wide eyes, mouth slightly open. She couldn't find words either.
Min turned back to Rand. When he'd been close to killing her with his own hand, she hadn't feared him. But then she'd known that it wasn't Rand hurting her, but Semirog. But this Rand, hand aflame, eyes so intent yet so dispassionate, terrified her.
"I've done it before," he whispered. "I once said that I didn't kill women, but it was a lie. I murdered a woman long before I faced Semirog. Her name was Leah. I killed her in Shadar Logoth. I struck her down and I called it mercy."
He turned to the fortress palace below.
"Forgive me," he said,
but it didn't seem directed at Min. For calling this mercy as well.
Something impossibly bright formed in the air before him, and Min cried out, backing away. The air itself seemed to warp, as if pulling away from Rand in fear. Dust blew from the ground in a circle around him, and the trees groaned, lit by the brilliant white light, the pine needles rattling like 100,000 insects scrambling over one another. Min could no longer make out Rand, only a blazing, brilliant force of light. Pure power gathered, making the hairs on her arms rise with the force of its nebulous energy. In that moment, she felt as if she could understand what the One Power was. It was there before her, made incarnate in the man Randall Thor. And then, with a sound like a sigh, he released it. A column of pure whiteness exploded from him and burned across the silent night sky, illuminating the trees below it in a wave. It moved as quick as a snap of the fingers, striking the wall of the distant fortress. The stones came alight, as if they were breathing in the force of the energy. The entire fortress glowed, transforming into living light, an amazing, spectacular palace of unadulterated energy. It was beautiful. And then it was gone, burned from the landscape and the pattern, as if it had never been there. The entire fortress, hundreds of feet of stone, and everyone who had lived in it. Something hit Min, something like a shocking wave in the air. It wasn't a physical blast, and it didn't make her stumble, but it twisted her insides about. The forest around them, still lit by the glowing access key in Rand's hands, seemed to warp and shake. It was as if the world itself were groaning in agony. It snapped back, but Min could still feel that tension. In that instant, it seemed as if the very substance of the world had been near to breaking.
"What have you done?" Nynaeve whispered.
Rand didn't reply. Min could see his face again, now that the enormous column of bale fire had vanished, leaving behind only the glowing access key. He was in ecstasy, mouth agape, and he held the access key aloft before himself as if in victory or in reverence. Then he gritted his teeth, eyes opening wide, lips parted as if he were under great pressure. The light flashed once, then immediately vanished. All became dark. Min blinked in the sudden darkness, trying to get her eyes to adjust. The powerful image of Rand seemed burned into her vision. Had he really done what she thought he had? Had he burned away an entire fortress with bale fire? All those people. Men returning from the hunt, women carrying water, soldiers on the walls, the grooms outside. They were gone. Burned from the pattern. Killed. Dead forever. The horror of it made Min stumble back, and she pressed her back against a tree to keep herself upright. So many lives, ended in an instant. Dead. Destroyed. By Rand. A light appeared from Nynaeve, and Min turned, seeing the Aes Sedai illuminated by the warm, soft glow of a globe above her hand. Her eyes seemed almost afire with a light of their own.
"You are out of control, Randall Thor," she declared. "I do what must be done," he said, speaking now from the shadows. He sounded exhausted. "Test him, Nynaeve."
"What?"
"The fool," Rand said. "Is her compulsion still there? Is Grendel's touch gone?"
"I hate what you just did, Rand," Nynaeve snarled. "No, hate isn't strong enough. I loathe what you've done. What has happened to you?"
"Test him," Rand whispered, voice dangerous. "Before condemning me, let us first determine if my sins have achieved anything beyond my own damnation."
Nynaeve breathed in deeply, then glanced at Ramchalan, who was still held in the grip of several Aiel maidens. Nynaeve reached out and touched his forehead, concentrating.
"It's gone," she said. "Erased."
Then she is dead, Rand said from the darkness.
Light, Min thought, realizing what he'd done. He didn't use Ramchalan as a courier or as bait. He used the man as a way of proving to himself that Grendahl was dead.
Balefire burned someone out of the pattern completely, making it so that their most recent actions never occurred. Ramchalan would remember visiting Grendahl, but her compulsion no longer existed. In a way, she'd been killed before Ramchalan had visited her. Min felt at her neck, where the bruises of Rand's hand on her neck hadn't yet faded.
I don't understand, Ramchalan said, his voice nearly a squeak.
How do you fight someone smarter than yourself? Rand whispered. The answer is simple. You make her think that you are sitting down across the table from her, ready to play her game. Then you punch her in the face as hard as you can. You've served me well, Ramchalan. I will forgive you for boasting to Lords Vivian and Caldwell that you could manipulate me however you wished.
Ramchalan slumped in shock, and the maidens let him fall to his knees.
My lord, he said, I had too much wine that night, and—
Hush, Rand said. As I said, you have served me well this day. I will not execute you. You will find a village 2 days' walk to the south.
With that, Rand turned. To Min's eyes, he was just a shadow rustling in the forest. He walked to the gateway and stepped through. Min hurried to follow him, and Nynaeve did likewise. The maidens came last, leaving Ramchalan kneeling stupefied in the forest. When the last maiden was through the gateway, the portal slid closed, cutting off the sounds of Ramchalan whimpering in the dark.
What you have done is an abomination, Randalthor, Nynaeve said as soon as the gateway was closed. There looked to have been dozens, maybe hundreds of people living in that palace.
Each one made into an idiot by Grendahl's compulsion, Rand replied. She never lets anyone close to her without destroying their mind first. The boy she sent to work the jail barely knew a fraction of the torture most of her pets receive. She leaves them without ability to think or act. All they can do is kneel and adore her, perhaps run errands at her command. I did them a favor.
A favor? Nynaeve asked. Rand, you used balefire. They were burned out of existence.
As I said, Rand replied softly, a favor. Sometimes I wish the same blessing for myself. Good night, Nynaeve. Sleep as well as you can, for our time in Arad Doman is at an end.
Min watched him go, wishing to sprint after him but holding herself back. Once he was gone from the room, Nynaeve slumped into one of the room's maroon chairs, sighing and leaning her head against her hand. Min felt like doing the same. Until that moment, she hadn't realized just how drained she was. Being around Rand lately did that to her, even when he wasn't engaged in activities as terrible as the ones this night.
I wish Moiraine were here, Nynaeve muttered softly,
then froze, as if surprised to have heard herself say that. We have to do something, Nynaeve, Min said, looking at the Aes Sedai. Nynaeve nodded absently.
Maybe. What do you mean by that?
Well, what if he's right? Nynaeve asked. Wool-headed fool though he is, what if he really does have to be like this to win? The old Rand could never have destroyed an entire fortress full of people to kill one of the Forsaken.
Of course he couldn't have, Min said. He still cared about killing men. Nynaeve, all these lives.
And how many people would still be alive now if he'd been this ruthless from the start? Nynaeve asked, looking away. If he'd been capable of sending his followers into danger as he did Ramchalan. If he'd been able to strike without worrying about whom he would have to kill. If he'd ordered his troops into Grendahl's fortress, her followers would have resisted fanatically and they would have ended up dead anyway. And she would have escaped. This might be what he has to be. The last battle is nearly upon us, Min. The last battle.
Can we dare send a man to fight the Dark One, who won't sacrifice for what needs to be done?
Min shook her head.
Dare we send him in as he is, with that look in his eyes? Nynaeve, he's stopped caring. Nothing matters to him anymore but defeating the Dark One. Isn't that what we want him to do?
She stopped.
Winning won't be winning at all if Rand becomes something as bad as the Forsaken.
I understand, Nynaeve said suddenly.
Light burn me, but I do, and you're right. I just don't like the answers those conclusions are giving me.
What conclusions?
Nynaeve sighed.
That Cadswain was right, she said. Nearly under her breath, she added, insufferable woman.
She stood up. Come on, we need to find her and discover what her plans are.
Min stood, joining Nynaeve.
You're certain she has plans?
Rand was harsh with her.
Maybe she's just staying with us to watch him flounder and fail without her.
She has plans, Nynaeve said. If there's one thing we can count on with that woman, it's that she's scheming. We just have to convince her to let us in on it.
And if she won't? Min asked.
She will, Nynaeve said, looking at the place where Rand's gateway had split the rug. Once we tell her about tonight, she will. I dislike the woman, and I suspect she returns the emotion. But neither of us can handle Rand alone.
She pursed her lips.
I worry we won't be able to handle him together. Let's go.
Min followed.
Handle? Rand? That was another problem. Nynaeve and Cadswain were both so concerned with handling that they failed to see that it might be best to help him instead. Nynaeve cared for Rand, but she saw him as a problem to be fixed, rather than a man in need. And so Min accompanied the Aes Sedai out of the mansion. They walked into the dark courtyard, Nynaeve making a globe of light, and hurried around the back, past the stable and toward the gatekeeper's cottage. They passed Olivia on the way. The former Damane looked disappointed. Likely she'd been turned away by Cadswain and the others again. Olivia spent a great deal of time trying to get the Aes Sedai to train her in new weaves. They finally reached the gatekeeper's cottage. At least the gatekeeper's cottage was what it had been, until Cadswain prevailed upon him to move out. It was a single-story, thatch-roofed structure of painted yellow wood. Light shone out between the shutters on the windows. Nynaeve stepped up to the front and knocked on the sturdy oak door. It was answered shortly by Maurice.
"Yes, child," the Green asked, as if intentionally trying to goad Nynaeve.
"I have to speak with Cadswain," Nynaeve growled.
"Cadswain Sedai, she has no business with you right now," Maurice said, moving to close the cottage door. "Return tomorrow, and perhaps she will see you."
"Randall Thor just burned an entire palace full of people from existence with balefire," Nynaeve said, loud enough to be heard by those inside the cottage. "I was with him."
Maurice froze.
"Let her in,"
Cadswain's voice said from inside. Reluctantly, Maurice pulled open the door. Inside, Min saw Cadswain sitting on some cushions on the floor with Amice, Bear, Milane, and Sorrelia. The front room, the main room, of the cottage was decorated with a simple brown rug on the floor, mostly obscured by the seated women. A gray stone fireplace burned with a calm flame at the back, the wood nearly consumed, the fire low. A stool sat in the corner with a pot of tea on it. Nynaeve barely gave the wise ones a glance. She pushed her way into the cottage, and Min followed more hesitantly.
"Tell us of this event, child," Sorrelia said. "We felt the world warping from here, but did not know what had caused it. We assumed it to be the Dark One's work."
"I'll tell you," Nynaeve said, then took a deep breath. "But I want to be a part of your plans."
"We shall see," Cadswain said. "Relate your experience."
Min took a seat on a wooden stool at the side of the room as Nynaeve gave her account of Natrin's barrow.
The wise ones listened, tight-lipped. Cadswain just nodded occasionally. Maurice, face full of horror, refilled cups of tea from the pot on the stool. By the smell it was Trimalkin black, then set it to hang by the fire. Nynaeve finished, still standing.
"Oh, Rand," Min thought, "this must be tearing you apart inside."
But she could feel him through the bond. His emotions seemed very cold.
"You were wise to come to us with this, child," Sorilea said to Nynaeve. "You may withdraw."
Nynaeve's eyes opened wide with anger. "But Sorilea," Cadswain said calmly, cutting Nynaeve off. "This child could be of use to our plans. She is still close to the Althor boy. He trusted her enough to take her with him this evening."
Sorilea glanced toward the other wise ones. Aged Bear and sun-haired Milane both nodded. Amice seemed thoughtful, but did not object.
"Perhaps," Sorilea said, "but can she be obedient?"
"Well?" Cadswain asked of Nynaeve. They all seemed to be ignoring Min.
"Can you?"
Nynaeve's eyes were still wide with anger. Light, Min thought. Nynaeve obey Cadswain and the others? She's going to explode at them. Nynaeve tugged on her braid with a white-knuckled grip.
"Yes, Cadswain Sedai," she said through clenched teeth. "I can."
The wise one seemed surprised to hear her speak the words, but Cadswain nodded again, as if she'd expected that response. Who could expect Nynaeve to be so, well, reasonable?
"Sit down, child," Cadswain said with a wave of the hand. "Let's see if you can follow orders. You might be the only one of the current crop who is salvageable."
That made Maurice flush.
"No, Cadswain," Amice said. "Not the only one. Egwene has much honor."
The other two wise ones nodded.
"What is the plan?" Nynaeve said.
"Your part in it is," Cadswain began.
"Wait," Nynaeve said. "My part? I want to hear the whole thing.
You'll hear when we're ready to tell you," Cadswain said curtly. "And don't make me regret my decision to speak on your behalf."
Nynaeve forced her mouth shut, eyes aflame, but she did not snap at them.
"Your part," Cadswain continued, "is to find Perrin Abara."
"What good will that do?" Nynaeve asked, then added,
"Cadswain Sedai." "That is our business," Cadswain said. "He has been traveling in the south recently, but we can't discover exactly where. The Althor boy might know where he is. Find out for us, and perhaps I'll explain the point."
Nynaeve nodded reluctantly, and the others turned to a discussion of how much strain from balefire the pattern could take before unraveling completely. Nynaeve listened in silence, obviously trying to glean more about Cadswain's plan, though there didn't seem to be many clues. Min only half listened. Whatever the plan, someone would need to watch out for Rand. His deed this day would be destroying him inside, no matter what he proclaimed. There were plenty of others worrying about what he would do at the last battle. It was her job to get him to that last battle, alive and sane, with his soul in one piece. Somehow.
Chapter 38 News in Telaran Riod.
"Egwene, see reason," Swan said, faintly translucent because of the Terangreal ring she had used to enter Telaran Riod. "What good can you do, rotting in that cell? Elida will see that you're never let free, not after what you said you did at that dinner."
Swan shook her head.
"Mother, sometimes you just have to face truth. You can only repair a net so many times before you need to toss the thing aside and weave a new one."
Egwene sat on a three-legged stool in the corner of the room, the front part of a cobbler's shop. She'd chosen the location at random, just in case, eschewing a location in the White Tower itself.
The Forsaken knew that Egwene and the others walked the world of dreams. With Swan, Egwene could be more relaxed, more her real self. The two of them both understood that Egwene was now the Ammerlin and Swan her lesser, but at the same time they shared a bond, a camaraderie due to the station they both had filled. That bond, strangely, had turned into something akin to friendship. At the moment, Egwene was nearly ready to strangle her friend. "We've been over this," she said firmly. "I cannot flee. Each day I spend imprisoned but do not break is another blow to Elida's rule. If I disappear before her trial, it will undermine everything we've worked for." "The trial will be a sham, Mother," Swan said. "And if it isn't, the punishment will be light. From what you told me, she didn't break any bones when she beat you. Why, she didn't break the skin." That was true. Egwene's bleeding had been from broken glass, not Elida's stripes. "Even a formal censure from the hall will undermine her," Egwene said. "My resistance, my refusal to break my imprisonment, means something. The sitters themselves come to visit me. If I were to flee, it would look as though I'd given in to Elida." "Didn't she declare you a dark friend?" Swan asked pointedly. Egwene hesitated. "Yes, Elida had done that. But she didn't have proof for it." Tower law was intricate, and sorting out the proper punishments and interpretations could be complicated. The three oaths would have prevented Elida from using the one power as a weapon, and so Elida must have thought that what she was doing wasn't a violation. Either she had gone farther than she'd planned, or she saw Egwene as a dark friend. She could argue for either position to defend herself. The latter would relieve her of the most guilt, but the former would be much easier to prove. "She could succeed at having you convicted," Swan said, apparently thinking along the same lines. "You would be slated for execution. What then?" "She won't succeed. She hasn't any proof that I am a dark friend, and so the hall will never allow it."
"And if you're wrong?"
Egwene hesitated. "Very well. If the hall decides that I am to be executed, I will let you get me out. But not until then, Swan. Not until then."
Swan snorted. "You might not have an opportunity, Mother. If Elida cows them, she will act quickly. The woman's punishments can be swift as a storm wind, take you unaware. I know that for certain."
"If that happens," Egwene said pointedly, "my death would be a victory. Elida would be the one who gave up, not I."
Swan shook her head, muttering, "Stubborn as a mooring post."
"We are finished with that discussion, Swan," Egwene said sternly. Swan sighed but said nothing further. She seemed to have too much nervous energy to sit, and ignored the stool on the other side of the room, instead going to stand by the shop window to Egwene's right. The cobbler's sales room showed signs of great traffic. A stout counter divided the room in half, the wall behind pocketed with dozens of shoe-sized nooks. At times, most of these were stuffed with sturdy work shoes of leather or canvas, laces hanging down the front, or buckles gleaming in the phantom light of Telairun Riod. Yet each time Egwene glanced at the wall, the shoes had shifted, some vanishing, others appearing. They must not stay long in their cubbyholes in the real world, for they left only vague images behind in the world of dreams. The front half of the shop was crowded with stools for customers to use. The shoes on the back wall were of different designs and patterns, along with test shoes for sizing. A person came into the shop, tried on the sizing shoes, then picked a style. The cobbler, or likely his assistants, would then craft a pair for later pickup. The wide glass windows at the front proclaimed the name of the cobbler in white painted letters to be Naorman Mashinta, and a smaller number 3 had been painted beside the name. This was the third generation of Mashintas to run the shop. Not uncommon at all among townsfolk. In fact, the part of Egwene that was still influenced by the two rivers found it odd that anyone would consider leaving their parents' trade for another, unless they were a third or fourth child. "Now that we've dealt with the obvious," Egwene said, "what news is there?"
Well, Swan said, leaning on the window and staring out at the eerily empty Tarvalen street. An old acquaintance of yours recently arrived in camp.
Really?
Egwene asked absently.
Who?
Gawain Trakand. Egwene started.
That was impossible.
Gawain had sided with Elida's faction during the rebellion. He wouldn't have come over to the rebel side. Had he been captured? But that wasn't how Swan had phrased it. For a moment, Egwene was a trembling girl, caught in the power of his whispered promises. She managed to keep her form locked into that of the Ammerlin, however, and forced her thoughts back to the moment, driving herself to be casual as she responded.
Gawain, she asked. How odd. I wouldn't have thought to find him there.
Swan smiled. That was nicely handled, she said. Though you paused too long, and when you did ask for him, you were overly uninterested. That made you easy to read.
Light blind you, Egwene said.
Another test? Is he really there?
I hold to the oaths, thank you, Swan said, affronted.
Egwene was one of the few who knew that, as a result of her stilling and healing, Swan had been released from the three oaths. But like Egwene, she chose not to lie anyway. Either way, Egwene said, I should think that the time for testing me has passed.
Everyone you meet will always be testing you, Mother, Swan said.
You must be prepared for surprises. At any moment someone could throw one at you just to see how you respond.
Thank you, Egwene said coldly, but I really don't need the reminder.
Don't you? Swan said. Sounds a little like something Elida would say.
That's unfair. Prove it, Swan said smugly.
Egwene forced herself to be calm. Swan was right. Better to take the advice, particularly when it was good advice, than to complain.
You are right, of course, Egwene said, smoothing out her dress across her knees as she also smoothed the frustration from her face.
Tell me more of Gawain's arrival.
I don't know much more, Swan confessed. I really should have mentioned it yesterday, but our meeting was cut short.
They were meeting more often now, each night of Egwene's imprisonment. But yesterday something had awakened Swan before they had finished talking. A bubble of evil in the rebel camp, she had reported, involving tents coming alive and trying to strangle people. Three had died, one of them Aes Sedai.
Anyway, Swan continued, Gawain hasn't said much that I could hear. I think he's here because he heard that you were captured. He arrived with a spectacular flurry, but now he stays in Bryn's command post, visiting the Aes Sedai regularly. He's mulling over something. Keeps going to speak to Romanda and Lilaine.
That's troubling.
Well, they are the obvious power in camp, Swan said. Save when Shiriam and the others can wrench some authority away. Things haven't gone well without you. The camp needs leadership. Actually, we crave it, as a starving fisherman craves a catch.
Aes Sedai are a people of order, I suppose.
She stopped herself.
Likely she had been about to bully Egwene again to accept rescue. She glanced at Egwene, then continued.
Well, it will be good for us when you return, Mother. The longer you stay away, the stronger the factions become. You can almost see the lines down the middle of the camp now. Romanda on one side, Lilaine on the other, with a shrinking slice that doesn't want to take sides.
We cannot afford another division, Egwene said. Not among ourselves. We have to prove stronger than Elida.
At least our splits aren't along the lines of Aja, Swan said defensively.
Factions and breaks, Egwene said, getting up. In fighting and squabbling. We are better than this, Swan. Tell the hall that I wish to meet with them, perhaps in 2 days. Tomorrow you and I should meet again.
Swan nodded hesitantly.
Very well.
Egwene eyed her.
You think it unwise?
No, Swan said. I worry about how hard you're pushing yourself. The Ammerlin needs to learn to ration her strength. Some in your place have failed, not because they lacked the capacity for greatness, but because they stretched that capacity too thin, sprinting when they should have walked.
Egwene refrained from pointing out that Swan herself had spent much of her tenure as Amarlin sprinting at a breakneck speed. But it could very well be argued that Swan had stretched herself too thin, and had fallen as a result. Who better to speak on the dangers of such activities than one who had been burned by them so deeply? "The advice is appreciated, daughter," Egwene said. "But really there is little to worry about. My days are spent in solitude, with the occasional beating to provide spice. These meetings at night help me survive." She shivered, glancing away from Swan, out the window toward the dirty, vacant street. "Is it difficult to endure?" Swan asked softly. "The cell is narrow enough for me to touch opposite walls at once," Egwene said. "And it isn't very long, either. When I lie down, I have to bend my knees to fit. I can't stand, since the ceiling is so low it makes me stoop. And I can't sit without pain, for they no longer heal me between beatings. The straw is old and itches. The door is thick, and the cracks don't allow in much light. I wasn't aware that the tower had cells such as this one." She glanced back at Swan. "Once I am upheld fully as Amarlin, this room and any like it will be removed. The doors ripped out and the cells themselves filled with bricks and mortar." Swan nodded. "We'll make certain of it." Egwene turned away again, and noticed with shame that she'd let her gown shift to the cadensor of an Aiel maiden, complete with spears and bow at her back. She forced the clothing back, taking a deep breath. "No person should be kept in such a manner," she said. "Not even—" Swan frowned as Egwene trailed off. "What was that?" Egwene shook her head. "It just occurred to me. This is what it must have been like for Rand. No, worse. The stories say he was locked in a box smaller than my cell. At least I can spend part of the evenings chatting with you. He had nobody. He was without the belief that his beatings meant something." Light send that she didn't have to endure as long as he had. Her imprisonment had only been a few days so far. Swan fell silent. "Regardless," Egwene said, "I have Telairon Riod. During the days my body is captive, but my soul is free at night. And each day I endure is another proof that Elida's will is not law. She cannot break me. Her support from the others is eroding. Trust me." Swan nodded. "Very well," she said, rising. "You are Amarlin." "Of course I am," Egwene said absently. "No, Egwene," Swan said. "I meant that from the heart." Egwene turned, surprised. "But you've always believed in me." Swan raised an eyebrow. "At least," Egwene said, "from fairly near the beginning." "I always believed you had potential," Swan corrected. "Well, you've fulfilled it. Some of it, at least. Enough of it. However this storm blows through, you've proven one thing. You deserved the place you hold. Light girl, you may end up being the best Amarlin this world has known this side of Arthur Hawkwing's reign." She hesitated. "And that's not an easy thing for me to admit, mind you." Egwene took Swan's arms, smiling. Why, Swan almost looked teary-eyed with pride. "All I did was get myself locked in a cell." "And you did it like an Amarlin, Egwene," Swan said. "But I should be getting back. Some of us can't spend our days relaxing the way you can. We need real sleep, otherwise we're likely to fall unconscious in our wash water." She grimaced, releasing herself from Egwene's hands. "You could just tell him to—" "Now I'll have none of that," Swan said, wagging a finger at Egwene. Had she forgotten that she'd just been complimenting Egwene's stature as an Amarlin? "I gave my word, and I'll be fish guts before I'll break it." Egwene blinked. "I wouldn't dream of making you," she said, covering a smile, as she noticed that Swan's shadowy form now had a bright red ribbon in its hair. "Off with you, then." Swan nodded sharply, then sat down and closed her eyes. She faded slowly from Telairon Riod. Egwene hesitated, watching the area where Swan had been. It was probably time to return to normal dreaming,
letting her mind restore itself. But returning to her normal dreams would be a step toward waking. And when she woke, she would find only that cramped dungeon and its stuffy darkness. She longed to stay in the world of dreams just a little longer. She thought of visiting Elaine's dreams to ask for a meeting. But no, that would take too much time, assuming Elaine could make her dream Tarangreal work. She rarely could these days. She found herself stepping away from Tarvalin, the cobbler's shop vanishing around her. She appeared in the Rebel Eyes Sedai camp, a foolish place to visit, perhaps. If there were dark friends or forsaken in the world of dreams, they could very well be studying this camp and looking for information, much as Egwene sometimes visited the Ammerlin's study in Telairun Riad to search for clues on Elida's plans. But Egwene needed to come here. She didn't question why, she simply felt that it was true. The streets of the camp were muddy, worn in ruts from passing wagons. Once just a field, the area had been appropriated by the Aes Sedai and turned into something. Part a place of war, with Bryn's soldiers camped in a ring about them. Part town, though no town had ever boasted such a complement of Aes Sedai, novices and accepted. Part monument to the weakness of the White Tower. Egwene walked the camp's main thoroughfare, where weeds had been trampled to mud, then mud worn into a road. Walkways lined it, and tents covered the flat land beyond. There were no people, only the occasional fleeting glimpse of a sleeper who had stumbled into Telairun Riad. Here a brief flash of a woman in a fine green gown, a dreaming Aes Sedai, perhaps, though it was just as likely to be a serving maid imagining herself to be a queen. There, a woman in white, a woman with stringy blonde hair who was far too old to be a novice. That no longer mattered. The novice book should have long ago been opened to all. The White Tower was too weak to turn down any source of strength. Both women were gone almost as quickly as they appeared. Few dreamers stayed long in Telairun Riad. To remain longer, one needed either a particular skill like Egwene's, or a Tarangreal like the ring Swan used. There was a third way. Getting caught up in a living nightmare. There were none of the latter about, thank the light. The camp seemed strange to be so deserted. Egwene had long since stopped being unnerved by the eerie lack of people in Telairun Riad. But this camp was different somehow. It looked as a war camp might, after all of the soldiers had been slaughtered on the battlefield. Deserted, yet still a banner to proclaim the lives of those who had occupied it. Egwene felt as if she could see the division that Swan had talked about. Tents clumped together like bunches of sprouting flowers. With individuals removed, she could see the patterns and the troubles they bespoke. Egwene might denounce Elida for the rifts among the Ajahs in the White Tower, but Egwene's own Aes Sedai were beginning to fracture as well. Well, three Aes Sedai could hardly gather without two of them making an alliance. It was healthy to have the women planning and preparing. The trouble was when they began to regard others of their kind as enemies, rather than just rivals. Swan was right, unfortunately. Egwene could not spend much more time setting her hopes on reconciliation. What if the White Tower didn't unseat Elida? What if, despite Egwene's progress, the rifts between the Ajahs never healed? What then? Go to war? There was another option, one that none of them had brought up, that of giving up on reconciliation permanently, setting up a second White Tower. It would mean leaving the Aes Sedai broken, perhaps forever. Egwene shuddered at the prospect, and her skin itched, rebelling against the thought. But what if she had no other choice? She had to consider the ramifications, and she found them daunting. How could they encourage the kin or the wise ones to tie themselves to the Aes Sedai if the Aes Sedai themselves were not unified? The two White Towers would become opposed forces, confusing the leaders of men as rival Ammerlins tried to use nations for their own purposes. Allies and enemies alike would lose their awe of the Aes Sedai, and kings very well might start up their own centers for women talented in channeling. Egwene steeled herself, walking on the muddy road, the tents along the way changing, their flaps open, then closed, then open again, in the strange ephemeral way of the world of dreams. Egwene felt the Ammerlin's stole appear around her neck, too heavy, as if woven with lead weights. She would bring the White Tower Aes Sedai to her side. Elida would fall. But if not, then Egwene would do what was necessary in order to preserve the people and the world in the face of Tarmon Gaiden. She stepped away from the camp, the tents, ruts, and empty streets vanishing. Again, she wasn't certain where her mind would take her. Traveling in the world of dreams this way, letting need direct her, could be dangerous, but it could also be very illuminating. In this case, she looked not for an object, but for knowledge. What did she need to know? What did she need to see? Her surroundings blurred, then snapped back straight. She stood in the middle of a small camp, fire smoldering in a fire pit before her, a tiny tongue of smoke curling toward the sky. That was odd. Fire was usually too fleeting to reflect in Tel Arunriod. There were no actual flames, despite the smoke and the orange glow warming the smooth river stones that ringed the pit. She glanced upward, toward the too dark, stormy sky. That silent storm was another irregularity for the world of dreams, though it had become so common lately that she hardly noticed it anymore. Could anything be called regular for this place? With shock, she noticed colorful wagons around her, green, red, orange, and yellow. Had they been there a moment before? She was in a large clearing set inside a forest of phantom white aspen. The underbrush was thick, where spindly wild grass poked fingers out in jagged patches. An overgrown road meandered through the trees to her right. The colorful wagons sat in a ring around the floor. Bright paints colored the sides of the boxy vehicles, which had roofs and walls like tiny buildings. Oxen did not reflect in the world of dreams, but plates, cups, and spoons appeared, then vanished from places beside the fire pit or on the seats of the wagons. It was a camp of the traveling people, the Tuatha'an. Why this place? Egwene walked idly around the fire pit, looking at the wagons. The coats of paint kept fresh and free of cracks or stains. This caravan was much smaller than the one she and Perrin had visited so long ago, but it had much the same feel. She could almost hear the flutes and drums, could almost imagine those flickers from the fire pit to be the shadows of dancing men and women. Did the Tuatha'an still dance, with that sky so full of gloom, the wind so full of ill news? What place was there for them in a world preparing for war? Trollocs cared nothing for the Way of the Leaf. Did this group of Tuatha'an seek to hide from the last battle? Egwene settled herself on the side steps of a wagon, which was turned to face the nearby fire pit. For a moment she let her gown change to that of a simple woolen Two Rivers dress of green, much like the one she'd worn during her time visiting the traveling people. She stared into those non-existent flames, remembering and pondering. What had become of Aram, Rayan, and Isla? Likely they were safe somewhere in a camp just like this one, waiting to see what Tarmon Gaiden would do to the world. Egwene smiled, thinking of those days when she'd flirted and danced with Aram beneath Perrin's scowling disapproval. That had been a simpler time. Though the Tinkers always seemed able to make a simpler time for themselves. Yes, this group would still dance. They would dance right up until the day when the pattern burned away, whether or not they found their song, whether or not Trollocs ravaged the world or the Dragon Reborn destroyed it. Had she let herself lose sight of those things which were most precious? Why did she fight so hard to secure the White Tower? For power? For pride? Or because she felt it really was best for the world? Was she going to suck herself dry as she fought this battle? She had chosen, or would have chosen, the green and not the blue. The difference wasn't just that she liked the way the greens stood up and fought. She thought that the blues were too focused. Life was more complicated than a single cause. Life was about living, about dreaming, laughing, and dancing.
Gawain was in the Aes Sedai camp. She said that she'd chosen the green for its aggressive determination. It was the battle Aja. But a more secret, more honest part of herself admitted that Gawain was a motivation for her decision as well. Among the green Aja, marrying one's warder was common. Egwene would have Gawain for her warder, and her husband. She loved him. She would bond him. Those desires of her heart were less important than the fate of the world, true, but they were still important. Egwene rose from the steps as her dress transformed back into the white and silver gown of the Ummerlin. She took a step forward and let the world shift. She stood before the white tower. She turned her eyes high, running them along the length of the delicate, yet still powerful, white spire. Though the sky bubbled in black turmoil, something cast a shadow from the tower, and it fell directly on Egwene. Was this a vision of some sort? The tower dwarfed her, and she felt its weight, as if she were holding it up herself. Pushing on those walls, keeping them from cracking and tumbling. She stood for a long while there, sky boiling, the tower's perfect spire throwing its shadow down on Egwene. She stared up at its peak, trying to decide if it was time to just let it fall. No, she thought again. No, not quite yet. A few more days. She closed her eyes, then opened them to blackness. Her body suddenly exploded with pain, her backside pounded raw from the strap, her arms and legs cramped from being forced to lie curled in the small room. It smelled of old straw and mold, and she knew that if her nose hadn't been used to it, she would have smelled the stench of her own unwashed body as well. She stifled a groan. There were women outside, guarding her and maintaining her shield. She wouldn't let them hear her offer complaint. Not even in the form of a groan. She sat up, wearing the same novice dress that she'd worn to Elida's dinner party. The sleeves of the dress were stiff with dried blood, and this cracked as she moved, scraping against her skin. She was parched. They never gave her enough water. But she did not complain. No yells, no cries, no begging. She forced herself to sit up despite the pain, smiling to herself at how it felt. She crossed her arms, then leaned back, and one by one stretched the muscles in her arms. Then she stood and stooped over, stretching her back and shoulders. Finally, she lay down on her back and stretched her legs up into the air, cringing as they complained. She needed to remain limber. Pain was nothing. Nothing at all compared with the danger the White Tower was in. She sat back down, cross-legged, and took deep breaths, repeating to herself that she wanted to be locked in this room. She could escape if she wished, but she remained. By remaining, she undermined Elida. By remaining, she proved that some would not bow and quietly accept the fall of the White Tower. This imprisonment meant something. The words, repeated in her head, helped stave off the panic at considering yet another day within this cell. What would she have done without the nightly dreams to keep her sane? Again she thought of poor Rand, locked away. She and he shared something now, a kinship beyond a common childhood in the Two Rivers. They had both suffered Elida's punishments, and it hadn't broken either of them. There was nothing to do but wait. Around noon they would open the doors and drag her out to be beaten. It wouldn't be Sylviana who did the punishing. Giving the beatings was seen as a reward, compensation to the Red Sisters for having to spend all day sitting in the dungeons guarding her. After the beating, Egwene would go back in the cell and be given a bowl of tasteless gruel. Day after day it was the same. But she would not break, particularly not while she could spend the nights in Telairun Riod. In fact, in many ways, those were her days, spent free and active, while these were her nights in inactive darkness. She told herself that. The morning passed slowly. Eventually, iron keys clanked as one turned in the ancient lock. The door opened, and a pair of slender Red Sisters stood outside, barely silhouettes, the light so unfamiliar to Egwene that she couldn't make out their features.
The Reds grabbed her roughly by the arms, though she never resisted. They pulled her out and threw her to the ground. She heard the strap as one slapped it against her hand in anticipation, and Egwene steeled herself for the blows. They would hear her laugh, just as they had every day before.
"Wait," a voice said.
The arms holding Egwene down grew stiff. Egwene frowned, cheek pressed against the cold tile floor. That voice, it had been Katarine's. Slowly the sisters holding Egwene relaxed their grips, pulling her to her feet. She blinked against the blazing light of the lamps to find Katarine standing in the hallway a short distance away, her arms folded. "She is to be released," the Red said, sounding strangely smug.
"What?"
asked one of Egwene's captors. As her eyes adjusted, Egwene could see that it was Lanky Barrasine.
"The Amyrlin has realized that she is punishing the wrong person," Katarine said. "The failure lies not completely on the head of this insect of a novice, but on the one who was to be manipulating her."
Egwene eyed Katarine,
and then it clicked into place.
"Sylviana," she said.
"Indeed," Katarine said. "If the novices are out of control, then should not the blame fall on the one who was to train them?"
So Elida had realized that she could not prove Egwene was a dark friend. Deflecting attention to Sylviana was a clever move. If Elida was punished for using the power to beat Egwene, but Sylviana was punished far more for letting Egwene get out of control, it would save face for the Amyrlin.
"I think the Amyrlin made a wise choice," Katarine said. "Egwene, you are to be instructed from now on only by the Mistress of Novices."
"But Sylviana is the one you said has failed," Egwene said, confused.
"Not Sylviana," Katarine said. Her smugness seemed to grow even further. "The new Mistress of Novices."
Egwene locked gazes with the woman.
"Ah," she said. "And you believe that you will succeed where Sylviana failed?" "You will see."
Katarine turned away and headed down the tiled hallway.
"Take her to her quarters."
Egwene shook her head. Elida was more competent than Egwene had assumed. She'd seen that the imprisonment wasn't working and had found a scapegoat to punish instead. But Sylviana removed from her position as Mistress of Novices? That would be a blow to the morale of the tower itself, for many sisters considered Sylviana an exemplary Mistress of Novices. The Reds reluctantly began to walk Egwene toward the novices' quarters, now in their new location on the 22nd level. They seemed annoyed to have missed out on the opportunity to beat her. She ignored them. After spending so long locked up, it felt wonderful simply to be able to walk. It wasn't freedom, not with a pair of guards, but it certainly did feel like it. Light! She wasn't certain how many more days in that dank hole of a cell she'd have been able to stand. But she'd won. The realization was just beginning to dawn on her. She'd won! She'd resisted the worst punishment Elida could contrive and had come out victorious. The Amyrlin would be punished by the hall, and Egwene would go free. Each familiar hallway seemed to shine with a congratulatory light, and each step she took seemed like the victory march of 1,000 men across the battlefield. She had won. The war was not over, but this battle went to Egwene. They climbed some stairs, then entered the more populated sections of the tower. Soon she saw a group of novices passing. They whispered to one another as they saw Egwene, then scattered away. Within minutes, Egwene's little procession of three began to pass more and more people in the hallways, sisters of all Ajahs looking busy, yet their steps slowed as they watched Egwene pass. Accepted in their banded dresses were far less covert. They stood at intersections, gawking as Egwene was led past. In all of their eyes, there was surprise. Why was she free? They seemed tense. Had something happened that Egwene wasn't aware of?
"Ah, Egwene," a voice said as they passed a hallway.
"Excellent. You are already free. I would speak with you."
Egwene turned with shock to see Saren, the purposeful brown sitter. The scar on the woman's cheek always made her seem far more daunting than most other Aes Sedai, an air enhanced by the white locks of hair, indicating her great age. Few members of the Brown could be described as intimidating, but Saren was certainly one of that select group.
"We are taking her to her rooms," Barrasine said.
"Well, I will speak to her as you do," Saren said calmly.
"She is not, you deny me, Red?"
"A sitter?" Saren asked. Barrasine blushed.
"The Amyrlin will not be pleased to hear of this."
"Then run along and tell her," Saren said,
"while I discuss some items of import with young Alvir."
She eyed the Reds.
"Give us some room, if you please."
The two Reds failed to stare her down, then backed away. Egwene watched with curiosity. It appeared that the authority of the Amyrlin, indeed that of her entire Aja, was somewhat dimmed. Saren turned to Egwene and gestured, and the two of them began to walk together through the hallway, the Red Sisters following behind.
"You take a risk being seen speaking to me like this," Egwene said.
Saren sniffed. "Leaving one's quarters is taking a risk these days. I'm growing too frustrated with events to bother with niceties anymore."
She paused, then glanced at Egwene.
"Besides, being seen in your company can be rather worth that risk these days. I wanted to determine something."
"What?" Egwene asked, curious.
"Well, I actually wanted to see if they could be pushed around. Most of the members of the Red are not taking your release well. They see it as a major failing on Elida's part."
"She should have killed me," Egwene said with a nod.
"Days ago."
"That would have been seen as a failure."
"As much a failure as being forced to remove Sylviana?" Egwene asked.
"Of suddenly deciding that your mistress of novices is to blame a week after the fact?"
"Is that what they told you?" Saren asked, smiling as they walked, her eyes forward.
"That Elida suddenly came to this decision all on her own?"
Egwene raised an eyebrow.
"Sylviana demanded to be heard by the full hall while it was sitting," Saren explained. "She stood before the lot of us, before Elida herself, and insisted that your treatment was unlawful, which likely it was. Even if you aren't an Aes Sedai, you shouldn't have been placed in such terrible conditions."
Saren glanced at Egwene.
"Sylviana demanded your release. She seemed to respect you a great deal, I should say. She spoke with pride in her voice of how you'd received your punishments, as if you were a student who had learned her lesson well. She denounced Elida, calling for her to be removed as Amyrlin. It was quite extraordinary."
"By the light," Egwene breathed. "What did Elida do to her?"
"Ordered her to take up the dress of a novice," Saren said. "Just about caused an uproar in the hall itself."
Saren paused.
"Sylviana refused, of course. Elida has declared that she is to be stilled and executed. The hall doesn't know what to do."
Egwene felt a stab of panic.
"Light! She mustn't be punished. We must prevent this."
"Prevent it?" Saren asked.
"Child, the Red Aja is crumbling. Its members are turning against one another, wolves attacking their own pack. If Elida is allowed to go through with killing one of her own Aja, whatever support she had from within the ranks will evaporate. Why, I wouldn't be surprised when the dust settles to see that the Aja has undermined itself to the point that you could simply disband it and be done with them."
"I don't want to disband them," Egwene said.
"Saren, that's one of the problems with Elida's way of thinking in the first place. The White Tower needs all of the Ajas, even the Red, to face what is coming. We certainly can't afford to lose a woman like Sylviana just to make a point. Rally what support you can. We have to move quickly to stop this travesty."
Saren blinked.
"Do you really think you're in control here, child?"
Egwene met her eyes.
"Do you want to be?"
"Light, no."
"Well then stop standing in my way and get to work. Elida must be removed, but we can't let the entire tower collapse around us while it happens.
Go to the hall and see what you can do to stop this.
Saren actually nodded in respect before withdrawing down a side corridor. Egwene glanced back at her two red attendants.
Did you hear much of that?
They glanced at each other. Of course they'd been listening.
You'll want to go determine for yourselves what has happened, Egwene said. Why haven't you?
The two glanced at her with annoyance.
The shield, Barrasine said. We've been instructed to always have at least two to maintain it.
Oh, for the... Egwene took a deep breath.
If I vow not to embrace the power until I am properly back in the custody of another Red Sister, will that be enough for you?
The two regarded her with suspicion.
I suspected as much, Egwene said.
She turned to a group of novices who were standing in a side corridor, pretending to scrub the tiles on the side wall while they gawked at Egwene.
You, Egwene said, pointing to one of them.
Martial, isn't it?
Yes, mother,
the girl squeaked. Go and fetch us some fork root tea. Katarine should have some at the study of the Mistress of Novices. It's not far. Tell her that Barrasine requested it for use on me. Bring it to my quarters.
The novice scrambled off to do as asked. I'll dose myself with that, and then at least one of you can go, Egwene said. Your Aja is collapsing. They're going to need all of the clear minds they can get. Maybe you can convince your sisters that it is unwise to let Elida execute Sylviana.
The two Reds glanced at each other uncertainly. Then the spindly one whose name Egwene didn't know cursed softly and hurried away with a flurry of rustling skirts. Barrasine called after her, but the woman didn't return. Barrasine glanced at Egwene, muttered something under her breath, but remained in place.
We're waiting for that fork root, she said, staring Egwene in the eyes. Keep moving on to your quarters.
Fine, Egwene said. But each minute you delay could cost you deeply. They climbed the stairs to the new novices' quarters, which were scrunched up alongside the remainder of the brown section of the tower. They stopped by Egwene's door to wait for the fork root. As they stood there, novices began to crowd around. In the distant corridors, sisters and their warders ran through hallways with a sense of urgency. Hopefully, the hall would be able to do something to contain Elida. If she really went so far as to execute sisters for simply disagreeing with her... The wide-eyed novice finally returned with a cup and a small packet of herbs. Barrasine inspected the packet and apparently determined that it was satisfactory, for she dumped it into the cup and proffered it to Egwene expectantly. With a sigh, Egwene took it and downed the entire cup of warm water. It was enough of a dose that she wouldn't be able to channel a trickle, but hopefully wouldn't be strong enough to render her unconscious. Barrasine turned and hurried away, leaving Egwene alone in the hallway. Not just alone, but alone and able to do exactly as she wished. She didn't get many of these opportunities. Well, she'd have to see what she could do with that. But first, she'd need to change out of this filthy, blood-stained dress and wash herself, too. She pushed open the door to her quarters and found someone sitting inside.
Hello, Egwene, Varin said, taking a sip from a steaming cup of tea. My, I was beginning to wonder if I'd have to break into that cell of yours in order to speak with you.
Egwene shook off her shock.
Varin? When had the woman returned to the White Tower? How long had it been since Egwene had seen her?
There isn't time right now, Varin, she said, quickly opening the small locker that contained her extra dress. I have work to be about.
Yes, Varin said, taking a calm sip of her tea. I suspect that you do. By the way, that dress you are wearing is green.
Egwene frowned at the nonsense sentence, glancing down at her dress. Of course it wasn't green. What was Varin saying? Had the woman become... She froze, glancing at Varin. That had been a lie. Varin could speak lies.
Yes, I thought that might get your attention, Varin said, smiling. You should sit down. We have much to discuss, and little time in which to do it.
Chapter 39 A Visit from Varen Sedai.
You never held the oath rod, Egwene accused her, still standing by the closet. Varen remained on the side of the bed, sipping her tea. The stout woman wore a simple brown dress with a matronly cut through the bosom and a thick leather belt at the waist. The skirts were divided, and judging from the dirty boots peeking out from under the hem, she had only just arrived back in the White Tower.
Don't be silly.
Varen brushed back a lock of hair that had escaped from her bun. The brown was marked with a pronounced streak of gray.
Child, I held the oath rod and swore upon it before your grandmother was born.
Then you've had the oaths removed, Egwene said. It was possible with the oath rod. After all, Yukiri, Saren, and the others had removed their oaths and replaced them.
Well, yes, Varen said in a motherly way.
I don't trust you, Egwene found herself blurting. I don't think I ever have.
Very wise, Varen said, sipping her tea.
It was not a scent Egwene recognized.
I am, after all, of the Black Aja.
Egwene felt a sudden chill, like an ice-cold spike pounded directly through her back and down into her chest. Black Aja. Varen was black. Light. Egwene immediately reached for the one power, but of course the fork root made that effort futile. And Egwene herself had been the one to suggest it be given to her. Light, had she taken leave of her senses? She'd been so confident and certain following her victory that she hadn't anticipated what might happen if she ran into a black sister. But who could anticipate running into a black sister? Finding one sitting calmly on your bed, drinking tea, and looking at you with those eyes that always had seemed to know too much. What better way to hide than as an unassuming brown, constantly dismissed by the other sisters because of your distracted, scholarly ways?
My, but this is good tea, Varen said.
When you next see Laras, please thank her on my behalf for providing it. She promised that she had some that hadn't spoiled, but I didn't trust her.
Can't trust much these days, can you?
What? Is Laras a dark friend? Egwene asked.
Heavens no, Varen said. She's many things, but not a dark friend. You'd sooner find a white cloak marrying an Aes Sedai than find Laras swearing to the great lord. Extraordinary woman, and quite good at judging the flavor of teas.
What are you going to do with me? Egwene said, forcing herself to speak calmly. If Varen had wanted to kill her, the deed would have been done by now. Obviously, Varen wanted to use Egwene, and use would give Egwene opportunity. Opportunity for escape. Opportunity to turn the situation around. Light, this was bad timing.
Well, Varen said, first I will ask you to sit. I would offer you some tea, but I sincerely doubt you want any of what I'm having.
Think, Egwene, she told herself. Calling for help would be futile. Only novices were likely to hear, as her red keepers had both run off. Of all the times to be alone. She'd never have thought that she'd wish for jailers nearby. Anyway, if she yelled, Varen would undoubtedly bind and gag her with weaves of air. And if any novices did hear, they'd run to see what was the problem, and that would only pull them into Varen's clutches as well. So Egwene pulled over the room's single wooden stool and sat upon it, backside protesting the uncushioned wood. The small room was still and quiet, cold and sterile, as it had been unoccupied for 4 days. Egwene sought furiously for an avenue of escape.
I compliment you on what you've done here, Egwene, Varen said. I followed some little of the foolishness going on between the Aes Sedai factions, though I decided not to get involved personally. It was more important to continue my research and keep an eye on young Althor. He's a fiery one, I must say. I worry about the lad. I'm not certain he understands how the Great Lord works. Not all evil is as obvious as the Chosen, the Forsaken, as you'd call them.
Obvious? Egwene said. The Forsaken?
Well, by comparison.
Varen smiled and warmed her hands on her cup of tea.
The Chosen are like a bunch of squabbling children,
each trying to scream the loudest and attract their father's attention. It's easy to determine what they want. Power over the other children, proof that they are the most important. I'm convinced that it isn't intelligence, craftiness, or skill that makes one chosen, though of course those things are important. No, I believe it is selfishness the great lord seeks in his greatest leaders.
Egwene frowned. Were they really having a quiet chat about the Forsaken? Why would he choose that quality?
It makes them predictable. A tool you can depend upon to act as expected is far more valuable than one you cannot understand. Or perhaps because when they struggle against one another, it makes only the strong ones survive. I don't know, honestly. The Chosen are predictable, but the Great Lord is anything but. Even after decades of study, I can't be certain exactly what he wants or why he wants it. I only know that this battle isn't being fought the way that Althor assumes it will be.
And what does this have to do with me? Egwene asked.
Not much, Varin said, tisking at herself. I'm afraid I let myself get sidetracked. And with so little time, too, I really must pay attention.
She still seemed like the pleasant, scholarly brown sister.
Egwene had always expected that black sisters would be different. Anyway, Varin continued, we were talking about what you did here in the tower. I was afraid that I'd come and find you still dawdling with your friends outside. Imagine my amazement at finding that you'd not only infiltrated Elida's regime, but had apparently turned half of the hall itself against her. You've certainly riled some of my associates, I can tell you that. They are none too pleased.
Varin shook her head, taking another sip of tea.
Varin, I... Egwene paused. What is...
No time, I'm afraid, Varin said, leaning forward. Suddenly, something about her seemed to change. Though she was still the aged and at times motherly woman, her expression grew more determined. She caught Egwene's eyes, and the intensity within that gaze shocked Egwene. Was this the same woman?
Thank you for humoring a woman's rambles, Varin said, voice more soft. It was so very nice to have a quiet chat over tea, at least once more. Now, there are some things you need to know. A number of years ago, I faced a decision. I found myself in a position where I could either take oaths to the Dark One, or I could reveal that I had actually never wanted or intended to do so, whereupon I would have been executed. Perhaps another would have found a way around this situation. Many would have simply opted for death. I, however, saw this as an opportunity. You see, one rarely has such a chance as this. To study a beast from inside its heart, to see really what makes the blood flow, to discover where all of the little veins and vessels lead, quite an extraordinary experience.
Wait, Egwene said. You joined the Black Aja to study them?
I joined them to keep my skin intact, Varin said, smiling. I'm rather fond of it, though Tomas did go on about these white hairs. Anyway, after joining them, the chance to study them was my making the best of the situation.
Tomas, does he know what you've done?
He was a dark friend himself, child, Varin said. Wanting a way out. Well, there really isn't a way out. Not once the Great Lord has his claws in you. But there was a way to fight, to make up for a little of what you've done. I offered that chance to Tomas, and I believe he was quite grateful to me for it.
Egwene hesitated, trying to take all of this in.
Varin was a dark friend, but not one at the same time.
You said he was quite grateful to you?
Varin didn't answer immediately. She simply took another sip of her tea. The oaths one makes to the Great Lord are quite specific, she finally continued. And when they are placed upon one who can channel, they are quite binding, impossible to break. You can double-cross other dark friends. You can turn against the Chosen, if you can justify it. Selfishness must be preserved, but you can never betray him. You can never betray the Order itself to outsiders. But the oaths are specific. Very specific.
She looked up,
meeting Egwene's eyes.
I swear not to betray the great lord, to keep my secrets until the hour of my death. That was what I promised. Do you see?
Egwene looked down at the steaming cup in Varen's hands.
Poison? It takes a very special tea to make asping rot go down sweetly, Varen said, taking another sip. As I said, please thank Laris for me.
Egwene closed her eyes. Nynaeve had mentioned asping rot to her. A drop could kill. It was a quick death, peaceful, and often came within an hour of ingestion.
A curious hole in the oaths, Varen said softly, to allow one to effect a betrayal in the final hour of one's life. I cannot help wondering if the great lord knows of it. Why wouldn't he close that hole?
Perhaps he doesn't see it as threatening, Egwene said, opening her eyes.
After all, what kind of dark friend would kill themselves in order to advance the greater good? It doesn't seem the kind of thing his followers would consider.
You may be right at that, Varen said, setting the cup of tea aside.
It would be wise to make certain that is disposed of with care, child.
So that is it? Egwene asked, chilled. What of Tomas?
We made our farewells. He is spending his last hour with family.
Egwene shook her head. It seemed such a tragedy.
You come to me to confess? Killing yourself in a final quest for redemption?
Varen laughed.
Redemption? I shouldn't think that would be so easily earned. Light knows I've done enough to require a very special kind of redemption. But it was worth the cost. Worth it indeed. Or perhaps that is simply what I must tell myself.
She reached to her side, pulling a leather scrip from beneath the folded blanket at the foot of Egwene's bed. Varen carefully undid the straps, then produced two items, two books, both bound in leather. One was larger, like a reference book, though it had no title on its red binding. The other was a thin blue book. The covers of both were a little worn from use. Varen handed them to Egwene. Hesitantly, she took them, the larger volume heavy in her right hand, the blue book light in her left hand. She ran a finger over the smooth leather, frowning. She looked up at Varen.
Every woman in the brown, Varen said, seeks to produce something lasting, research or study that will be meaningful. Others often accuse us of ignoring the world around us. They think we only look backward. Well, that is inaccurate. If we are distracted, it is because we look forward, toward those who will come. And the information, the knowledge we gather, we leave it for them. The other Ajahs worry about making today better. We yearn to make tomorrow better.
Egwene set the blue book aside, looking into the red one first. The words were written in a small, efficient but cramped hand she recognized as Varen's. None of the sentences made sense. They were gibberish.
The small book is a key, Egwene, Varen explained. It contains the cipher I use to write this tome. That tome is the work, my work. The work of my life.
What is it? Egwene asked softly, suspecting she might know the answer.
Names, locations, explanations, Varen said. Everything I learned about them, about the leaders among the Dark Friends, about the Black Aja, the prophecies they believe, the goals and motivations of the separate factions, along with a list at the back of every Black Aja sister I could identify.
Egwene started.
Everyone? I doubt I caught them all, Varen said, smiling. But I think I got the large majority of them. I promise you, Egwene, I can be quite thorough.
Egwene looked down at the books with awe.
Incredible.
Light, but this was a treasure greater than any king's hoard. A treasure as great as the Horn of Valair itself.
She looked up, tears in her eyes, imagining a life spent among the black, always watching, recording, and working for the good of all.
Oh, don't go doing that, Varen said. Her face was beginning to look pale,
They have many agents among us, like worms eating the fruit out from the core. Well, I thought it time that we had at least one of us among them. This is worth one woman's life. Few people have had a chance to create something as useful and as wonderful as that book you hold. We all seek to change the future, Egwene. I think I might just have a chance at doing so.
Verin took a deep breath, then raised a hand to her head.
My, that does work quickly. There is one more thing I must tell you. Open the red book, please.
Egwene did so and found a thin leather strap with steel weights on the ends, the type used for marking one's place in a book, though it was longer than others she had seen.
Wrap it around the book, Verin said. Place it marking any page, then twist the loose ends around the top.
Egwene did so, curious, tucking the strap into a random page and closing the book. She put the smaller book on top of the larger one, then took the long ends of the bookmark that dangled down and twisted them about one another. The weights, she noticed, fit together. She locked them into place. And the books vanished. Egwene stared. She could still feel them in her hands, but the books themselves were invisible.
Only works on books, I'm afraid, Verin said, yawning. Someone from the Age of Legends, it appears, was very worried about hiding his or her journal from others.
She smiled slightly, but was growing very pale.
Thank you, Verin, Egwene said, unclasping and unwrapping the bookmark. The volumes appeared again. I wish there were some other way. I will admit that the poison was a backup plan, Verin said. I am not eager for death. There are still things I need to do. Fortunately, I have set several of them in motion to be seen to, in case I do not return. Regardless, my first plan was to find the oath rod, then see if I could use it to remove the Great Lord's oaths. The oath rod appears to have gone missing, unfortunately.
Saren, Egwene thought, and the others. They must have taken it again.
I'm sorry, Verin, she said. It might not have worked anyway, Verin said, settling back on the bed, arranging the pillow behind her streaked brown hair. The process of making those oaths to the Great Lord was distinctive. I do wish I'd been able to discover one more tidbit for you. One of the Chosen is in the tower, child. It's Messana, I'm certain of it. I had hoped to be able to bring you the name she was hiding under, but the two times I met with her, she was shrouded to the point that I couldn't tell. What I did see is recorded in the red book. Be careful where you tread. Be careful how you strike. I will leave it to you to decide if you want to try to get all of them at once, or if you want to take the most important ones separately in secret. Perhaps you will decide to watch and see if you can counter their plots. A good interrogation might yield light upon some of the questions I was not able to answer. So many decisions you must make for one so young.
She yawned, then grimaced as a pain stabbed her. Egwene rose, walking to Verin's side.
Thank you, Verin. Thank you for choosing me to carry this burden.
Verin smiled faintly.
You did very well with the previous tidbits I gave you. That was quite the interesting situation. The Amyrlin commanded that I give you information to hunt the Black Sisters who fled the tower, so I had to comply, even though the leadership of the Black was frustrated by the order. I wasn't supposed to give you the Dreaming Tirangreal, you know, but I've always had a feeling about you.
I'm not certain I deserve such trust. Egwene looked down at the book.
Trust such as you've shown.
Nonsense, child, Verin said, yawning again, eyes closing.
You will be Amyrlin, I'm confident of it. And an Amyrlin should be well armed with knowledge. That, among all things, is the most sacred duty of the Brown, to arm the world with knowledge. I'm still one of them. Please see that they know, although the word black may brand my name forever, my soul is brown. Tell them.
I will, Verin, Egwene promised.
But your soul is not brown. I can see it.
Her eyes fluttered open, meeting Egwene's,
a frown creasing her forehead.
"Your soul is of a pure white, Varen," Egwene said softly, "like the light itself."
Varen smiled, and her eyes closed. The actual death was a few more minutes in coming, but unconsciousness came first and swiftly. Egwene sat, holding the woman's hand. Elida and the hall could see to themselves. Egwene had prepared her seeds well. Showing up now and making demands would be to overextend her authority. After Varen's pulse faded, Egwene took the cup of poisoned tea and set it aside, then raised the saucer up in front of Varen's nose. The shiny surface reflected no fog. It felt callous to double-check, but there were some poisons which could make one appear to be dead and breathe only very shallowly. And if Varen had wanted to trick Egwene and point a finger at the wrong sisters, this would have been a wonderful method. Callous indeed to double-check, and it made Egwene feel sick, but she was Amarlin. She did that which was difficult, and considered all possibilities. Surely no truly black sister would have been willing to die just to create such misdirection. Her heart trusted Varen, although her mind wanted to be certain. She glanced toward her simple desk, where she had set the books. At that moment, the door to her room opened without warning, and a young Aes Sedai, new enough to the shawl that her face didn't show the ageless look yet, peeked in. Therese, one of the Red Sisters. So someone had finally been assigned to watch over Egwene. Her period of freedom had come to an end. Well, there was no use crying over what could have been. The time had been well spent. She wished Varen had come to see her a week earlier, but what was done was done. The Red Sister frowned at seeing Varen, and Egwene quickly raised a finger to her lips and shot the young sister a harsh look. Egwene hurried to the door.
"She just got in and wished to speak to me regarding a task she had set me upon long ago, back before the tower split. They can be oddly single-minded at times, these brown sisters."
True words, every one of them. Therese nodded ruefully at the comment about Browns.
"I do wish she'd chosen her own bed to lie down in," Egwene said. "I'm not sure what to do with her now."
All true again.
Egwene really did need to get her hands on that oath rod. Lying started to seem far too convenient at times like this.
"She must be tired from her travels," Therese said, voice soft but firm.
"You let her do as she wishes. She is Aes Sedai, you simply a novice. Do not disturb her."
With that, the Red closed the door, and Egwene smiled to herself in satisfaction. Then she glanced at Varen's corpse, and the smile faded. Eventually, she would have to reveal that Varen had died. How would she explain that? Well, she would think of something. If pressed, she might just tell the truth. First, though, she needed to spend some time with that book. The chances of it being taken from her in the near future were great, even with the bookmark Turangrial. She should probably store the cipher separate from the concealed book. Perhaps memorize and destroy the cipher. This would all be easier to plan for if she knew how events had gone in the hall. Had Elida been deposed? Was Sylviana alive, or had she been executed? There was little she could discover now, not while being guarded. She would simply have to wait and read. The code proved to be rather complex, requiring a good part of the smaller book to explain. That was both advantageous and frustrating. It would be very difficult to break the code without it, but the code would also be near impossible to memorize. She wouldn't be able to manage it before morning, by which time she would have to reveal Varen's true state. She glanced over at the woman. Varen really did look as if she were sleeping peacefully. Egwene had pulled out the blanket and covered her up to the neck, then taken off her shoes and set them beside the bed to enhance the illusion. Feeling a little disrespectful, she decided to roll Varen onto her side. The Red Sister had already peeked in a couple of times, and seeing Varen in another position would look less suspicious. That finished, Egwene glanced at her candle to judge the passage of time. There were no windows in the room, not in a novice's quarters.
She shoved aside the longing to embrace the power and create a ball of light by which to read. She'd have to be satisfied with the single candle's flame. She dug into her first task, deciphering the names of the Black Sisters listed at the back of the tome. That was more important even than memorizing the cipher. She had to know whom she could trust. The next few hours were among the most disturbing and discomforting in her life. Some of the names were unknown to her, many barely familiar. Others were women she had worked with, respected, and even trusted. She cursed when she found Katarine's name near the head of the list, then hissed in surprise when Alviarin's name came up. She'd heard of Elza Penfell and Galina Kazban, though she didn't know some of the next few names. She felt a sickening pit within her when she read Shirion's name. Egwene had once suspected the woman, true, but that had been during her days as a novice and an accepted. During those days, the days when she'd first begun hunting the Black Aja, Leandrin's betrayal had still been fresh. Egwene had suspected everyone then. During the exile in Saladar, Egwene had worked closely with Shiriam and had grown to like the woman, but she was black. Egwene's own keeper was black. "Steel yourself, Egwene," she thought, continuing to read down the list. She worked through the feelings of betrayal, the bitterness, and the regret. She would not let emotions get in the way of her duty. The Black Sisters were spread across all Ajahs. Some were sitters. Others were the lowest and least powerful of Aes Sedai. And there were hundreds of them, a little over 200 by Varen's own account. 21 in the blue, 28 in the brown, 30 in the gray, 38 in the green, 17 in the white, 21 in the yellow, and a stunning 48 in the red. There were names of accepted and novices as well. The book noted that those had probably been dark friends before they joined the White Tower, as the Black Aja did not recruit from any except Aes Sedai. It referred her to an earlier page for a longer explanation, but Egwene continued down the list of sisters. She needed to know the names of each woman. She needed to. There were Black Sisters among the rebel Aes Sedai and those of the White Tower, and even some among those unaligned who had been away from the tower during the split. Other than Shiriam, the most disturbing discovery on the list were the sisters who were sitters in either the tower or among the rebels. Duhara Basahin, Velina Behar, Sedora Dajena, Delana Mosalane, of course, and Talin Minley as well. Medani had admitted to Egwene in confidence that Talin was the member of the Black Aja that Saren and the others had discovered, but she had fled the tower. Moria Karantanis, that last was a member of the Blue Aja, a woman who had worn the shawl for over 100 years, known for her wisdom and level-headedness. Egwene had conferred with her on numerous occasions and had drawn on her experience, assuming that she, a Blue, would be one of the most reliable in her support. Moria had been one of those who had been eager to elect Egwene as Amarlin, and had stood quickly in Egwene's favor at several crucial moments. Each name was like a thorn through Egwene's skin. Thagdara Finchi, who had healed Egwene once when she'd stumbled and twisted her ankle. Zanika, who had taught Egwene lessons and had seemed so pleasant. Larissa Lindell, Miyasi, for whom Egwene had cracked nuts, Nasita, Nasella Kayama, Nalane Forel, who, like Elza, was bound to Rand, Birlin Pena, Melvara, Chai Rugan. The list went on. Neither Romanda or Lilane were black, which was somewhat irritating. Being able to throw one or both of those into chains would have been very convenient. Why Shiriam, but neither of those two? "Stop it, Egwene," she thought. "You aren't behaving rationally." Wishing for certain sisters to be black got her nowhere. Cadswain was not on the list. Neither were any of Egwene's dearest friends. She hadn't expected them to be, but it was still good to complete the list without seeing any of their names. The group hunting the Black Aja in the White Tower really was true, as none of their names were on the list. The list also didn't contain the names of any of the spies sent from Saladar.
and Elida's name wasn't on the list either. There was a notation at the end explaining that Verin had looked very closely at Elida, searching for proof that she was black. But comments by black sisters led her to believe strongly that Elida was not herself black, just an unstable woman who was sometimes as frustrating to the black as she was to the rest of the tower. It made sense, unfortunately. Knowing that Galena and Alviarin were black had led Egwene to suspect that she wouldn't find Elida's name on the list. The blacks seemed more likely to choose someone they could manipulate to be Amarlin than install a black keeper to keep her in line. They probably had used some kind of leverage against Elida through Galena, whom Verin noted had probably managed to make herself head of the Red Aja, or Alviarin. They had bullied or bribed Elida to do as they wished without her knowing that she was serving the Black. And that helped explain Alviarin's strange fall. Had she gone too far, perhaps? Overstepped herself, earning Elida's ire? It seemed plausible, though they wouldn't know for certain until Elida spoke, or Egwene could have Alviarin interrogated, which she meant to do as soon as possible. She closed the fat red book, thoughtful. Her candle burned nearly down to the base. It was growing late in the day. Perhaps it was time to insist on being given some information about the state of the tower. Before she could decide how to go about that, a knock came at the door. Egwene looked up, hurriedly twisting the straps of the bookmark around and making both books vanish. A knock meant someone other than a red was there. "Come," she called. The door opened to reveal Nicola, with her large dark eyes and slender build, standing outside beneath the watchful eye of Therese. The red did not seem pleased that Egwene had a visitor, but the steaming bowl carried on Nicola's tray indicated why she'd been given leave to knock. Nicola curtsied to Egwene, her white novice dress fluttering. Therese's scowl deepened. Nicola didn't notice, however. "For Verin Sedai," she said softly, nodding toward the bed. "By orders of the Mistress of Kitchens, after hearing how exhausted Verin Sedai was from her travels." Egwene nodded, gesturing toward the table, hiding her excitement. Nicola approached quickly, setting the tray on the table, whispering under her breath, "I'm to ask if you trust her." She glanced at the bed again. "Yes," Egwene answered, covering the sound by scooting her stool back. So her allies didn't know that Verin was dead. That was good. The secret was still safe for the moment. Nicola nodded, then spoke in a louder voice. "It would be good for her to eat it when it's warm, though I'll leave it to you if you wish not to wake her. I'm instructed to warn you not to touch it yourself." "I won't do so unless it turns out that she has no need of it," Egwene replied, turning away. A few moments later, the door closed behind Nicola. Egwene waited a painful few minutes for Therese to open the door and check on her, passing the time by washing her face and hands and putting on a clean dress. Finally, confident she wouldn't be interrupted, she grabbed the spoon and fished in the soup. Sure enough, she found a small glass vial with a rolled-up piece of paper in it. Clever. Her allies had apparently heard of Verin's presence in Egwene's room and decided to use it as an excuse to get someone in. She unrolled the paper, which contained only one word. "Wait." She sighed, but there was nothing to do. She didn't dare get out the book and continue reading, however. Soon she heard voices outside, and what sounded like an argument. Another knock came at the door. "Come," Egwene said, curious. The door opened, and Medani stepped into the room. She pointedly closed the door on Therese. "Mother," she said, curtsying. The slender woman was wearing a tight gray dress which pulled a little too obviously across her ample chest. Had she been scheduled for a dinner with Elida this evening? "I'm sorry to keep you waiting." Egwene waved dismissively. "How did you get past Therese?" "It is known that Elida favors me with visits," she said. "And tower law says that no prisoner can be forbidden visitors. She could not stop a sister from wishing to visit a simple novice, though she did try to make a point of arguing it." Egwene nodded,
and Medani glanced at Verin, frowning. Then she paled. Verin's features had grown waxy and dull, and it was obvious that something was wrong. It was a good thing that Therese had never looked closely at the sleeping woman. "Verin Sedai is dead," Egwene said, glancing at the door.
"Mother?" Medani asked. "What happened? Were you attacked?"
"Verin Sedai was poisoned by a dark friend shortly before her conversation with me. She was aware of the poison and came to pass on some important information to me during her last moments."
It was incredible what a few true statements could conceal.
"Light," Medani said. "A murder inside the White Tower? We have to tell someone. Gather the guard and it will be dealt with," Egwene said firmly. "Keep your voice down and pull yourself together. I don't want the guard outside to hear what we are saying." Medani paled, then looked at Egwene, likely wondering how she could be so callous. "Good. Let her see the collected, determined Amarlin. As long as she didn't see a hint of the grief, confusion, and anxiety inside."
"Yes, mother,"
Medani curtsied.
"Of course, I apologize."
"Now you bring news, I assume?"
"Yes, mother,"
Medani said, composing herself.
"Saren instructed me to come to you. She said you would need to know of the day's events."
"And I do," Egwene said, trying not to show her impatience. "Light, but she'd already been able to figure out that part. Couldn't the woman get on with it? There were Black Aja to deal with."
"Elida is still Amarlin," Medani said, "but only by a hair. The Hall of the Tower met and censured her formally. They informed Elida that the Amarlin was not an absolute ruler and that she couldn't continue to make decrees and demands without consulting them."
Egwene nodded.
"Not an unexpected turn," she said.
More than one Amarlin had become only a figurehead because she'd overextended herself in a similar way. It was what Elida had been heading for, and that would have been satisfactory had these not been the end of days.
"What of penance?"
3 months, Medani said. "One for what she did to you, 2 for behavior unbecoming her station."
"Interesting," Egwene said, thoughtful.
"There were some who called for more, mother. It seemed that for a moment she might be deposed right there."
"You were watching?" Egwene asked with surprise.
Medani nodded. "Elida asked for the proceedings to be sealed to the flame, but she gained no support in the move. I think that her own Aja was behind that, mother. All 3 of the Red's sitters are out of the tower. I still wonder where Duhara and the others went."
"Duhara, a black. What is she up to? And the other 2? Were the 3 together? And if so, could the other 2 be black as well?"
"She'd have to address that later."
"How did Elida take all of this?"
"She didn't say much, mother," Medani said. "She sat and watched, mostly. She didn't look very pleased. I was surprised she didn't start ranting."
"The Reds," Egwene said.
"If she is really losing support in her own Aja, they'd have warned her ahead of time not to make more waves."
"That was Saren's assessment as well," Medani replied.
"She also noted that your own insistence that the Red Aja not be allowed to fall, spread by a group of novices who overheard you, was part of what kept Elida from being deposed."
"Well, I wouldn't mind her deposed," Egwene said. "I just didn't want the entire Aja disbanded.
Still, this might be for the best. Elida's fall has to come in a way that doesn't tear the tower down with her."
"Though if Egwene could do it again, she might retract those words said earlier. She didn't want anyone to think that Egwene had been supporting Elida."
"I assume that Sylviana's sentence has been dismissed?"
"Not completely, mother," Medani said. "She is being held as the hall decides what to do with her. She still defied the Amarlin in a very public way, and there is talk of penance."
Egwene frowned. It smelled of a compromise. Elida had probably met in closed conference with the head of the Red Aja, whoever that was, now that Galena had vanished, hashing out the details. Sylviana would still be punished, although not as strongly, but Elida would submit to the will of the hall. It indicated that Elida was on shaky ground, but that she could still make demands.
Her support wasn't as completely eroded within her own Aja as Egwene had hoped. Still, this was a fortunate turn of events. Sylviana would live, and Egwene, it appeared, would be allowed to return to her life as a novice. The sitters were displeased enough with Elida to reprimand her. Given just a little more time, Egwene was confident she could get the woman overturned and the tower reunited. But dared she spend that time? She glanced at the table, where the precious books lay hidden from eyes. If she staged a mass assault on the Black Aja, would that precipitate a battle? Would she destabilize the tower even further? And could she realistically hope to strike at all of them like that? She needed time to consider the information. For now, that meant staying in the tower and working against Elida. And, unfortunately, that meant letting most of the Black Sisters run free. But not all of them. Medani, Egwene said. I want you to report to the others. They must take Alviarin into captivity and test her with the Oath Rod. Tell them to take any reasonable risk to achieve it.
Alviarin, Mother? Medani asked.
Why her? She's Black, Egwene said, stomach turning. And near the head of their organization in the tower. This was the information Varin died to bring me. Medani paled.
Are you certain, Mother?
I'm confident in Varin's trustworthiness, Egwene said. But it would still be advisable to have others remove, then replace Alviarin's oaths, and ask her if she's Black. Every woman should be given that chance to prove herself, no matter the evidence. You do have the oath rod, I assume?
Yes, Medani said.
We needed it to prove Nicola's trustworthiness. The others wanted to bring some accepted and novices in, as they can run messages where sisters cannot go. It was wise, considering the divisions among the Ajas.
Why her?
Because of how often she speaks to the others about you, Mother, Medani said. It's well known that she's one of your greatest advocates among the novices. It was odd to hear that of a woman who had effectively betrayed her, but the girl couldn't really be blamed for that, all things considered.